Hello, everyone who made it here for Daylight Savings Time. Did any of you actually come at 10 thinking you're coming to the 9? Nobody will raise their hand. Nobody did that? All right. I didn't see anybody crowd in here at that point. Well, welcome to Jacob's Well. It's good to see you all this morning. We are, as I think David pointed out, we're in the middle of a series in Lent looking at ancient disciplines that have informed our faith. We spent the first 3 weeks talking about some of the ways we discipline our lives materially. We talked about the sacred meal, about fasting, about tithing. And last week we started into the four disciplines that shape our lives temporally, where we're talking about fixed daily prayer last week. And this week we're going to talk about the weekly discipline of Sabbath, that as Jesus does with everything, kind of morphs in different directions that we might not have expected. And so today we're going to be looking at the Sabbath and spending some time looking at how Jesus affects that, the way he affects so many things. And so just to start off, just thinking about this concept of Sabbath, when I heard I was speaking on this, I thought, why me? Like, no way, like, Sabbath, like, that's something, you know, somebody who every week has a Saturday night to Sunday night kind of rhythm that never fails does this thing, they should be speaking about Sabbath. And I actually have met people that have done that for a couple of years just this morning, and it was, it's really pretty amazing and inspiring. But anyway, no, I got to preach on a hard subject that I don't entirely practice the way that we would expect someone like me to. And so I have a feeling that most people here would probably be on the same page. So I don't feel bad. But I feel like, dude, you are the only person in the room who don't do that every week. So I don't think that's the case. So with the whole idea of Sabbath, I was kind of thinking, you know what? Tim always does this to me. He gives me the topics that are hard because he doesn't want to preach on them. And I was thinking back, and I was like, I've preached a lot of Mother's Days. I've preached a lot of Father's Days. I've preached a lot of the hard passages in Mark. I've preached several Super Bowls. He's just doing that because he doesn't want to preach on those topics. But then I stopped. I was like, wait a minute. No, Tim preached on tithing. Tim preached on fasting. He preached on fixed daily prayer. So I guess he picked the hard ones too. So anyway, I can't be thinking it's a conspiracy. So anyway, it's not. I got Sabbath though, and actually, when I started digging into it, it really excites me. Not just for the practical benefits that it brings, but for the way that it's drawn me into the scriptures in a way this week to really engage with Jesus, and the way that he has shaped the Sabbath around himself, and the way the scriptures tend to like point things toward Christ continually. And so I figure anything that's going to get me connected straight to the heart of Christ, whatever subject, I'll do it no matter how hard it is. It's been a really good thing. And so this week we're gonna dig into the Sabbath discipline and look at it from some perspectives in scripture and from Jesus. But that being said, at first I thought, when I just was initially thinking Sabbath, I was like, well, duh, but you just rest, right? Is that the point? Is it just like common sense? I'm sure a lot of people have probably had this conception at one point. It's like, yeah, doesn't that just mean you take a day off? Isn't that obvious? And it might be in our culture to some degree the idea of a day off. In the time period, that was revolutionary for people, especially for people who were ex-slaves, to have that happen. But for us, I think that we tend to think of that, and we're not really connecting with the gravity of what this is, this privilege that God has extended to his people by setting up these ways of living, these ways of creating space for him to enter in and do unexpected things. And the Sabbath is a powerful means of grace in our lives in that regard. I want to read a bit that kind of inspired me by Abraham Joshua Heschel. You've read some of this stuff. I know some of you guys have probably been familiar with Abraham Joshua Heschel. He's a Jewish writer, philosopher, and poet. He writes some great stuff on a lot of subjects. And he had a book called Sabbath, fittingly. And I was looking at that this week, and he said this. He said, "Technical civilization is man's conquest of space. It is a triumph frequently achieved by sacrificing an essential ingredient of existence, namely time. In technical civilization, we expend time to gain space. To enhance our power in the world of space is our main objective, but to have more does not mean to be more." He goes on to say later, "The meaning of the Sabbath is to celebrate time rather than space. 6 days a week, we live under the tyranny of things of space. On the Sabbath, we try to become attuned to holiness and time. It is a day on which we are called upon to share in what is eternal in time, to turn from the results of creation to the mystery of creation, from the world of creation to the creation of the world, and to the Creator Himself. We can access a life beyond ourselves when we can enter into this place of recognizing that God has invited us into a place of rest. And it's primarily about relationship and presence. The idea is that this is not an individual exercise that we do to replenish ourselves to accomplish all the tasks we want to do. That's, I think, how the system would teach us to think of it. Like, okay, I've got to recharge. No, the idea is for ancient Jews and modern Jews too, the observant Sabbath-keeping Jews, they look at their whole week as leading up towards this day. That's the pinnacle in the time of joy and delight. Everything else is serving that. So the Sabbath is not a means to an end. It's an end in itself. And for Christ followers, this takes on an added dimension. And I want us to read a passage together from Mark chapter 2. Jesus interacts around the Sabbath concept. I think 6 different occasions all told throughout the Gospels, if I'm remembering that right. But if we have that Mark 2 passage, do we have that for the screen? We didn't use it earlier. If it's not there, it's no big deal. I can just read it. No, that's a Deuteronomy. There it is. All right. Excellent. Yeah, well, if you would read this with me, join me. Mark 2, 23 through 28. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" He answered, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar, the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat. And he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.'" Any impressions, thoughts stand out to you from this passage? Yeah, Kendra. It's like nanny, nanny, nanny. I like the way that your tone of voice took that too. She said, I've always wondered, thought this passage was funny because Jesus says, "But David did it." I can picture my daughter's voice right there. That's hilarious. Yeah, Brian. Yeah, no, that's important to think about with all the disciplines as we've been trying to keep that in mind as we go through these, because it's really easy to think of them as another task. Brian was saying he likes the concept that it's a gift and not simply another task, which, yeah. Yeah. He's pointing out that Jesus is really challenging the fact that they've just created kind of a ritual, it seems like, that's lost touch with what's really going on and why they do it. And Jesus is really engaging this intentionally and from a place of knowledge. David?
I'm just careful. When Jesus said the Sabbath wasn't made for man, or that man wasn't made for the Sabbath was made for man. That's kind of a profound thought.
Yeah, David is saying that he thinks it's profound the fact that he says that the man wasn't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for people. That's really pretty intense. I mean, it goes against the grain, I think, of what a religious mind would teach us, that we're supposed to be underneath something. And Brian pointed that out too. This is something that's a gift to give. It's given to us. Yeah, this concept of Sabbath is huge, and it's something that stems from a very early time in our corporate history is the people who worship the God we worship, that basically we have got this Sabbath ritual that's been handed down to us from, I said 4,000 years this morning. I can't remember really. I should have thought about that exactly. But basically, for thousands of years, we've carried on this tradition. And it comes from a time that, and it's significant, the time period that we understand this prescription that we have, because it was a time when our people were in slavery in Egypt. Some of you guys know the story of the Christian faith. You know the story of Scripture. And back in the book of Exodus, we see this thing played out. But even before that, the roots of what are going on here go back into the book of Genesis, where we have the patriarch Jacob, the son of Abraham, the one who God called to be a blessing to all people. We have Jacob in the promised land, still a wanderer and not settled permanently in his homeland yet. And suddenly he finds that there's a famine and there's no food anywhere in the promised land that he's been called to. And so it provokes a crisis. He's, God, you've called me to be here. What am I going to do? And at that time is all through centuries, all the way up at least through Roman times, Egypt was the breadbasket of the Mediterranean world. And so people would go there for their food in times of famine. And so you've got Jacob at a point where he realizes, I've got to send my sons, I've got to send my family down to this place, Egypt, to get the food to keep me alive, because they've got the source for that. Now, read the last 10 chapters or so, 10 chapters of Genesis sometime, about the story of Joseph. There's actually a prehistory to that too, which I won't get into, but basically one of his sons had gone before him and ended up being the way, the means of salvation for the whole family when they came there in that time of famine. He was already there through some difficult circumstances. And so in Egypt, these people settled, about 70 people settled there. And after several hundred years, the regime basically changed, and the king of that empire, the pharaohs, they changed. A new dynasty came along, and in Exodus it says that a king arose who did not know Joseph, who didn't know the person who was originally gaining favor with the kings in the early times. And so when this king arose, he said, look, these people are a threat. They had multiplied a lot by that point, and they basically said, we're going to enslave this group that could be a threat to us. They're in the middle of our empire, and we want to make sure that they're not a threat. And so they enslave them. They turn them into basically tools, machines to build their monuments, their buildings. And this is the roots of our identity as people who worship our God in the Christian and carrying on from the Hebrew faith before us. We take identity there. When God comes and says, I haven't forgotten you, I'm going to draw you out of Egypt. I'm going to draw you out of slavery. I'm going to bring you through the Red Sea and rescue you and deliver you with my power, so that the whole world can know that I am God and the whole world can see the mighty things I've done. And so this is what happens. A man named Moses rises up and is God's instrument of deliverance for these people to come out of slavery. And God also uses this man, Moses, to be the person who sets down the laws that God gives to his people. The instructions is a better word. The Hebrew word is Torah, which means a way, or the instructions for living. And we sometimes call it law, but I think in our setting, when we say law, it means something that may be more akin to what Brian was pointing out. It sounds more like a task than a gift. And really, what God gave, this Torah, this instruction, this way of life, was a gift to these people. And it's a gift to us still, as we are moving in the way of Jesus and receiving that tradition. And at the very center of this way that God passed on, there were these 10 words, the 10 commandments, as we call them. And they're found in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy 5. And I'm not going to have us project them again, but I'm just going to read this one section that talks about the longest and the most developed law in the Ten Commandments is this part about the Sabbath in Exodus 20, verse 8 through 11. It says, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. That word holy probably has a lot of resonances from people of different backgrounds, I think, in our modern setting. Depending on what branch of Christianity you may have been exposed to early on, that may have a good or a bad sound to it. And just to look at what's going on here, God is basically saying, look, I've set this apart as something special that's actually a container of something really precious. This is basically a thing that I have ordained to be a way of receiving grace. And it's like a big cup of good things that God has filled up for our purpose. He set it aside for that purpose so that we can receive what is good that God puts inside of it. It's a means of grace is another way to put it. Or it's in the language we use for certain aspects of the life of the church, we call things sacraments. Basically, that means a holy thing. That means something that's set apart for a purpose because it's a way that God extends life and grace to us. The Eucharist that we receive every Sunday, this is a sacrament. We identify this is a way that God imparts grace to us. The sacrament of baptism is another way in the Christian faith that we identify that God gives grace to us. He brings us into his covenant that through that avenue. And the Sabbath, this precious part of time that God has circumscribed for his purposes, this is a place where God has put grace that's available to bless his people. And that's what God is doing here when he makes this thing holy. He's setting it apart and filling it with something good for us that we can receive from. And so it's not, as Jesus points out, it's not that we're made for that. It's that the Sabbath is made for us. The Sabbath is a place. It's a place carved out in time for us to receive the good things God has for us. This man, Abraham Heschel, he also says something else about this that really helps unpack it. He says, a little bit later in this same section, if I have the page I was looking for, that would be helpful. There. He says this about this concept of God making it holy. He says, one of the most distinguished words in the Bible is the word kadosh, holy, a word which more than any other is representative of the mystery and majesty of the divine. Now, what was the first holy object in the history of the world? Was it a mountain? Was it an altar? It is indeed a unique occasion at which the distinguished word kadosh is used for the first time. In the book of Genesis, at the end of the story of creation, it's in the first few verses of Genesis chapter 2. How extremely significant is the fact that it is applied to time. The first time God designates something is sacred this way, he says, and God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. There is no reference in the record of creation to any object in space that would be endowed with the quality of holiness. It seems as if to the Bible, it is holiness in time, the Sabbath, which comes first beyond any other physical thing in space. God made time sacred. And there's something about that that's really important to realize is that's not something that we can influence or shape. When I was a kid, I actually had this idea that when we did daylight savings time, still if I let myself go into my mind, I can still get hung up on this. I thought that when we changed our clock, somehow we were controlling time. Like when we changed that thing, and it puzzled me. I was like, how on earth can that little clock control the hours of the day? That doesn't make sense. The whole world, the whole universe changes because we change the clock. I must have been a weird little kid because I don't think anyone else is resonating with that at all. Sorry. There you go. I was a weird kid, but it puzzled me. I was given to like pondering things like that were weird. And so anyway, the thing is that we can't influence time literally. We can influence our convention, we can change the setting, but the sun is still going to rise in the same period of hours that it did. And this morning, if any of you guys were up early, you would have seen that it was dark a lot later than it should have been. We can't control time. We can't make that happen. This is something that God invites us into. It's his sacredness. It's a sacred space that is his to offer us that we can come and receive, and all we can do is receive. We can't do anything or give anything to make this happen. We can receive it. We can enter in and participate, but it's not something we gain by putting our own touch on it. So he was referring to Genesis chapter 2, and it's really fascinating because right what happens there, God creates the universe, time, space, everything, and in 6 days in chapter 1. And each day has a partner. There's an even number, and it's fascinating to look through Genesis chapter 1 sometime and see how each day is connected intricately. There's a partner for each day. There's usually a form that God creates, like light and dark, and then there are stars and planets that fill the roles of the light and dark. Each of those days has a partner. But then there's the seventh day. It has no partner. It has no relationship to connect to. It's almost as if there's a longing built into the end of the story here where God says, look, I've created this for you. I need a partner. I've created this for something. And then immediately in Genesis chapter 2, we see the story of humanity. And we see that partner coming about. And so God has created really a relational time in this idea of the Sabbath. The point of it is to have presence. The point of it is relationship. And that's why when people partake of this, when people observe and keep the Sabbath, it's a time of relationship. It's a time of focusing on God and focusing on our family and focusing on people around us and being immediate to them. Not doing things that are useful per se, being with them. The being with, the thing that the Bible talks about over and over again, this idea that God with us, this Emmanuel, this incarnation, that's the idea. This is a space where we can be present in an incarnational, real God with us with God, us with each other sense. Which is why Jesus influences this concept so much and why it's such a natural fit for Jesus to come along and identify the Sabbath with himself. I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. He says, the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. He says, look, this is about me. The point is to have relationship with me. I'm at the center of this whole process here. And so for us Christ followers, this idea of Sabbath takes on a huge connotation that is new in the substance of our faith at the coming of Jesus, because suddenly the point is to focus and recognize and desire this person, this man, Jesus Christ. And so what happens is we basically say, look, the day of the resurrection of Jesus is the most sacred day. That's the day when life begins for the world. The creation is renewed. And so for us, the Sabbath takes place on Sundays as the traditional first day, or the eighth day is what we would say in the new creation language of the resurrection. And so we come and we gather in a place like this. Christians all over the world do this. Every week they gather in a place like this, typically in the morning. We're kind of untraditional. We have an evening thing too, so we're kind of whatever. We do both. So we got the whole day covered. But you've got Christians all over the world doing this. And it's interesting, because what really the Sabbath does is it basically says to the system, to the empire, the way it did originally, it says, you know what, there's a space and time carved out where we're not useful to you. We're not useful to the world system around us. This is a time where we do something that looks completely absurd to you. We come, we gather together with people that know this person, Jesus, and we sit, we listen to preaching, we engage in singing, we pray together. We do these things that make no sense if you're outside of this relationship, outside of the space carved out in time. I like the way that William Willimon describes this in his book, The Truth About God. He says, talking about the Ten Commandments in general, he says, the commandments are not guidelines for humanity in general. They are a countercultural way of life for those who know who they are and whose they are. Their function is to produce a people who are in our daily lives a sign, a signal, a witness that God has not left the world to its own devices. We have the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, because we have been delivered and redeemed by God. And so the practices we undertake, they're a way of embodying this life of God that he's invited us into. They're a way of creating a community, an alternate structure in the world where we gather on this sacred time for this sacred relationship with Christ and his people. So Sabbath keeping, it's really not the point itself. It's not so much really, when it comes down to it, for us about keeping Sabbath, about being Sabbath keepers, as it is about being Sabbath givers. As we look at Jesus and what he calls us into, there's this idea that we, as we partake in that relationship, that we become a means of grace as well. When we receive this sacrament, we receive this grace, this relationship, this time we gather in the presence of Christ and each other. We receive grace. It makes us able to give Sabbath, not just to observe, to give out of that overflow. In Luke 4, I'm not going to read the passage, but sometime if you want to write this down, look at Luke 4, verses 16 through 21. Jesus, in that chapter, in that section, he's inaugurating his ministry. He identifies himself at the outset as the person who's bringing the Jubilee year. He says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to set the oppressed free, to bring sight to the blind, etc., etc. And then he says, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, which initially sounds kind of like a strange concept. So what? What does that mean? That's rooted in this idea of the Jubilee year, which is actually a product of the Sabbath. And just in a nutshell, Every 7 years in ancient Israel, in the book of Leviticus, you can read about this practice. Every 7 years, God had ordained that the land would lie fallow, that they would not use that plot of land. It was a Sabbath of years. It was a Sabbath of weeks in the week, and there was also a Sabbath ritual built into the years. God actually cared about the land's productivity, and he said, I want this to rest every 7 years. And during that time, the poor could use the land, people who didn't own it, and animals, etc. God cared about all kinds of the aspects of society there. But what's fascinating is every seven cycles, every seven Sabbaths of years, the 49th to the 50th year there, they had a jubilee, they called it. They had a year of release. And what happened at this time is all debts were canceled for people within this community. That if you had been sold into some kind of servitude for whatever reason, which was very normal in the ancient world, people did this and you didn't get out of it. This is a revolutionary way of saying, look, you're not going to be sold into that slavery system. You are going to be released. At that appointed time, it's over. The person better get ready to let you go. There's a year of release. Actually, the word jubilee means release. It also means that your family land that you had to sell for some reason to get yourself out of trouble, it returned to the family that it originally was a part of. It was. You can imagine, some of you guys who know economics, how this would really create an interesting situation and change a lot of the ways they did. And it actually totally changed the way business would have been run. They evaluated by the time of the jubilee year. So this idea of this release, Jesus is referring to the Sabbath of Sabbath years, and he's saying, look, this idea here, this is what I'm bringing. I'm bringing the ultimate expression of Sabbath. I'm bringing release. I'm bringing jubilee in my footsteps. And so by relating to me, you're partaking of this release, this gracious year of God's favor. So as people who follow in the footsteps of Jesus, people who are a part of the body of Christ as we identify ourselves in this community that's centered around him, how might we be Sabbath givers? How might we extend ourselves, the grace that God has put in us, the ability to release that God has put in us? What does it look like in our lives, in our areas of influence, to be givers of Sabbath? We can observe and keep Sabbath, and we're enabled to give that. We're enabled to extend that grace to other people around us. And an example, a perfect example of this, I don't know if he's here today, but a guy in our congregation, Clay Masters, he extended Sabbath to me in a very powerful way that I'll never forget. Basically, I have never stood somebody up for a meeting in my entire life, and I stood him up for a meeting one time, and I was like, oh, I feel awful. Okay, well, we'll figure something out. I've only done that twice. I did it to the same person both times. I did it to Clay again. It's so ironic. Like, what are the chances that could possibly happen to the same person? And this is someone I really enjoy being around. Are you here, Clay? He might be at the evening. Anyway. And so I'm just thinking, okay, this guy deserves to just ream me. This guy deserves to stop talking to me. I have no idea how this happened, but I just deserve any kind of abuse that he wants to pour out on me or any demand he makes. I should take him out to some fancy dinner, whatever. I don't know. But I was really anticipating that he would just be kind of cold. I didn't think he would really be weird or anything. I just thought he'd probably just be kind of cool and think, yeah, you really don't care about me, do you? Which is totally untrue. He didn't do that at all. In fact, we talked about it, and I just was hanging my head, and I was like, oh, you can imagine what this would feel like. And you know what? He extended total grace. He said, look, don't worry about it. I was like, look, I'll make it up to you. He's like, no, you don't need to make anything up to me. I forgive you. It's not a big deal. There's no problem. I'm not going to hold this over you in any way, shape, or form. I totally am fine. I forgive you. He said, this wasn't cool, you know. He said, I forgive you. That means that he blamed me for it, and I deserve that. But he said, look, I'm not going to hold this over you. This isn't something that we can just, our friendship is not affected. And that was powerful. I mean, I didn't even get a trace of any weirdness. You know, even sometimes when people say that, you'll get a little weirdness. They'll kind of know that they've got something on you. He doesn't do that. You guys are laughing because you know you felt this passive-aggressive thing from people. He didn't do that at all. And so it was the most amazing measure of grace, of Sabbath being extended to me, that I was given an access into this sphere that he had that he could have influenced for good or for ill. And that was a powerful occasion. And so I really was moved by that situation. So it makes me want to ask us, so what are areas in our lives where we might be able to extend grace, that we might actually be able to draw people into the Sabbath release that God has allowed us to be a part of? And it's something that I would like us to continue to ponder over. As we think of Sabbath, I think that the natural thing to do would be to say, okay, let's find three ways that I can implement 24 hours out of my week. Let's talk about that and give me the application points or whatever. And obviously, we're not going to do that. But the idea here, there's something far deeper that can generate from. And it's this idea that we have got this access to the life of God in this place. And when we can enter that space, whatever form that takes, there's not a prescription that I'm going to offer. The classic form is a 24 hours every day at the same time. But I don't know if that's going to happen for all of us here in the next week or something. But I encourage you to find those places where you can enter the Sabbath rest, where you can enter that place, that means of grace, where you intentionally say, I'm not going to do my busy, productive work that I do all the rest of the time. I'm going to set this time aside for relationship with God, with family, with other people, and I'm not going to do anything that would remove my presence at all from them. And I think all of us know what that feels like, whether it's from parents or whether it's from friends. You know what it feels like when someone isn't entirely present. I mean, not everyone can be present 100% all the time, but you know what it's like for a parent. I mean, I can say, I know what this is like to do this to my daughter. I can say that I'm guilty of doing this, and I hate the fact that I do this. But I could be with her, and I could be thinking about 16 other things, thinking, okay, right now she turned around, she's playing with that toy. Okay, I can figure some stuff out in my mind. Okay, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. I think she picks up on the fact that I'm not entirely there. And I think we all know what I'm talking about. There's a time in Sabbath where we can learn to discipline ourselves, to be present with those we love, to be present with God. And it's a discipline, like all of these things. We learn to grow into it. And we don't have to spring full-born into it overnight. But it's a place where God will give grace to us. And so finally, the idea of being a Sabbath giver, it's potent, it's powerful, it's something that we have in our capacity. I think we've been trained by our culture, though, to sometimes think that I have to give all the time, and if I ever stop giving, that somehow I'm defective. I think a lot of people have this burden that has been ingrained for whatever reason, that if I'm not doing something productive for a person that might have a slight need in their life, well, therefore, I'm failing them in some way. And so as a result, we have a constant, never-ending list. And I think this happens a lot of times with mothers a lot of times. I see this with mothers of small children. They've constantly got needs in their life, and then other people come along that add to those needs. You guys, be really sensitive to people with little kids, like mothers of small children, because they've already got a lot of their emotional energy invested there. And they typically are built in such a way that they do give naturally, too. So it would be easy to try to elicit more. And so the knowledge that, no, you can rest, you can have a space carved out that is a place for relationship with God, with family, not a place to get more stuff done. This is crucial because you're never going to be able to give well until you learn to receive well. God's created a space and time for you to come and access his life. Receive that. It's really hard for some people to receive. In some ways, it's so much easier to give, because you're the one in charge. You're setting the tone, and people might owe you or something afterwards. It's so much harder to simply receive, and so much harder sometimes to bound out that space and say, this is a place for God and family and not for being productive. So I encourage you to avail yourself of that means of grace that God has offered. And don't let this turn into some kind of a work that you have to accomplish. It'd be easy to say, okay, well, whatever it looks like, I've got to make this happen. It's a burden. I'm going to take on another task. There's a part of us that this guy, Simona Weil, I have this book that I read of devotional pieces of prayers. And she said something that was profound that I read the last week about this. She said that we may have to strive after virtue with an effort of our will is one of the lies invented by the mediocre part of ourselves in its fear of being destroyed. Such an effort does not threaten it in any way. It does not even disturb its comfort, not even when it entails a great deal of fatigue and suffering. For the mediocre part of ourselves is not afraid of fatigue and suffering. It is afraid of being left behind. And so, I encourage you to not respond to that voice that says you have to strive and make some willpower thing out of this idea, this discipline. Don't let that mediocre part of yourself turn this into something it's not. See it as a place of grace that God is inviting you to. He's calling you to come and join him, to be present, to let your presence be with God's presence, and to be filled in that space. And out of that overflow, that's where life will take place. That's where you will be a blessing to those people that you desire to give and to love. And so along those lines, the idea of receiving, I think, sometimes I think it's hard to grasp. So we're going to do something a little different today in terms of communion. I'm not sure if the worship... Is the worship team still busy? Am I really short? Are they down? You don't have to get them or anything. I'm going to go towards communion, though. Basically, I'm going to set it up right now by telling you guys, here's how we're going to do... Oh, I'm sorry. You guys are sitting right there. You know, I'm so used to, like, going so late that they're all standing there staring at me by now that I'm like, what's going on? Totally ruined the mood. All right. Forget it. We'll just do the normal. No, just to understand this idea of reception, we're going to do communion a little bit different, nothing radically different this time, but basically I'm going to ask you guys to realize that in order to receive something, you have to let something else go. And so I'm going to ask you to come with your hands open to communion, and you're going to receive the cup. This is the server is going to hand that to you and say, the cup of Christ. And then you're going to receive that. And then the server is going to take a piece of bread, and they're going to hand that to you and say, the body of Christ, and you're going to receive that. And then at Jacob's, we do a process called intinction, where we dip the bread into the grape juice and eat it. We don't drink out of the cup, for those of you guys who are new. So that you're going to receive that, and then you can hand the cup. But I think people who've served communion have had people try to forcibly drink from the cup before, and it's interesting power struggle that can happen. I'm one of those people that won't let you do it. You'll have to fight me to do it. I see some people give in too. So anyway, we dip though. So I'm going to ask you to come up there open hands and just recognizing that you have to let something go to receive something better sometimes. That's what we're talking about, receiving the gift, the grace that God has for you. And so I'd like to invite you to come up. I'm going to read from the Apostle Paul, who passed on this tradition in these words in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes."